1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 355, One Room, Two Classes, Gender Differences in Sunday School Discussions, a paper by Karen D. Austin. The comments are by Catherine Fletcher Fowles, and the chair is Sherry B. Thornick. This is a one-hour session recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Can everybody hear? Sounds like we're fine. Looks like we're a little sly. I think everybody's still on their way back from lunch. Kind of hard when you have to leave campus to eat. But we'll get started and hope they kind of trail in as we go along. You are in the session, One Room, Two Classes, Gender Differences in Sunday School Discussions. Our presenter will be Karen D. Austin, and our comments will be made by Catherine Fletcher Fowles. Fowles? Am I saying that right? Fowles. Okay. Karen is joining us all the way from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So she's made a long trip to be with us, and we're excited to have her here. Karen is married to Michael Austin and has a young son named Porter. I think he's only 6 months old, did you say? Karen received her bachelor's degree in English with a minor in Near Eastern Studies from Brigham Young University in 1984. She received her master's degree in English studies with a minor in psychology from Brigham Young University in 1991 and has did graduate coursework in composition and rhetoric at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee from 1992 to 1996. Karen is currently working at Shepherd's College in West Virginia as the director of the Writing Center, and she is a gospel doctrine teacher in her ward there. Catherine, the names are close, so don't want to get them mixed up here. Catherine lives here in Salt Lake, but she wanted it known that she was born in Boston, raised in New Jersey, and has lived in Boston, New Mexico, and California. So she's not been in the state for a good part of her life, but she has the last 15 years, she said. She received her Bachelor of Science degree in Journalism from the University of Utah, and she is currently a volunteer release time seminary teacher at East High School in Salt Lake. She has a husband, 4 children, 1 son-in-law, 1 daughter-in-law, parents, and 7 younger siblings. So we'll turn the time over to them now.
I'm going to move away from the lectern or you'll never see me, so since I'm height disadvantage. I went ahead and typed this out so that I can remember to say what I wanted to say and that I can somehow maybe keep within time limits, otherwise I tend to ramble. While attending gospel doctrine over the last several years, I've noticed that the same few class members make the majority of the comments. At first, I thought perhaps these talkative students were merely outgoing or better educated than the quieter members of the class. But then I noticed that the same shy women who rarely spoke during gospel doctrine walked down the hall for the next hour of worship and transformed into avid participants in their women-only classroom. It was then that I decided to focus my informal observations on the role gender plays in the amount and kinds of comments made in gospel doctrine classes. I have developed an even greater interest in this topic since being called in June of this year to teach gospel doctrine in my ward in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I imagine that my interest in this topic not only stems from my current calling, but also from the graduate work I have pursued in composition and rhetoric. Many of my classes in teaching methods and the philosophies of language center on questions of gender. How does gender affect perception? How do men and women use language differently? How do women and men differ in the content and style of their comments? The underlying question often boils down to this. How do men and women, and indeed do men and women, differ in their intellectual, psychological, and moral development? My graduate studies were aimed in part at helping me run a writing classroom that would encourage both men and women to improve their writing and to help them participate fully in class discussion. So naturally, I'm curious to see how this same dynamic plays out in a Sunday school classroom. Even though Sunday school classes reject or at least temper many academic traditions, such as skepticism or undue reliance on quantifiable data, I believe that some of the questions and research about gender differences in the academic classroom can still be applied to the church classroom. A couple of years ago, I tried to present to others in my Santa Barbara ward my questions about gender and some of the research I had found on the topic of how gender affects classroom dynamic. I experienced only limited success. When I was called in 1997 to attend the teacher development course in Santa Barbara, I expected that part of our training would include a discussion on how to involve students who have various learning styles. I expected the training materials to include contemporary education theory on the differences among visual learners, verbal learners, and so forth, or maybe even a discussion centered on the questions of gender differences. However, I found that the printed curriculum did not discuss gender differences at all. I brought this up with the leader of the teacher development class, and when she and I later tried to bring up the topic of gender as a dimension of teacher preparedness, two of the most outspoken members of the teacher development class, both of whom happened to be male, were very adamant that gender played no role in determining who made comments in class. Furthermore, they said to suggest as much was foolish political correctness. Because these members of the class found and other members of the class found this conflict contentious, any further discussion of the topic was shut down. This cold reception, however, persuaded me to read more on the topic and to question classroom discussion that leaves many women quiet during mixed gender discussions. For a time, I thought I might pursue this topic by creating this data set so that I could formalize my analysis. I could supervise audio taping of gospel doctrine classes across the United States, in my ward and several others, so I might gather data on the number of comments made by women and the nature of their comments. But rummaging around in a few books, I found that several sociolinguists have already done this labor-intensive work. And I am going to assume some parallels between a college classroom and an adult Sunday school classroom, at least until I invest in a caseload of audio cassettes and a transcriber. Because I do believe in the value of observable data, let me start by summarizing the findings of some of these sociolinguistics on the subject of gender differences. The summary of this scholarship is found in a book by Mary Belenke and her co-authors, and I've produced this and a few other key quotes on this pink handout that you'll find on some of the chairs. And this is quote number one. The burgeoning field of sociolinguistics focuses on male and female patterns of discourse, sex-linked language, and sex differences in conversational patterns. Women's talk, in both style, being hesitant, qualified, question posing, and content, the concern for everyday, the practical, and the interpersonal, is typically devalued by men and women alike. Women talk less in mixed groups and are interrupted more often. I would also like to add that other research shows that women's comments in mixed gender groups are also generally shorter. Their comments are shorter than men's. Even though I still find the idea of taping a compelling project, I decided instead on a more manageable project for this paper. I will investigate a few key texts on this topic, texts from psychology, sociolinguistics, philosophy, and composition, and apply these findings to the general gospel doctrine setting. I could also ask how these two settings, academic classroom and church classrooms, may differ. I think that's a really good question, and how these differences might influence the ways men and women talk in public or formal church settings. But that's another paper topic, so I'm going to bracket those questions for now. The first work I would like to introduce and apply to a Sunday school setting is one that many of you may have already read, since for a time it was a number one national bestseller. Sociolinguist Deborah Tannen has written You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, which is a pop linguist book that represents her observations on the differences between two dialects, or genderlects, as she calls them. She claims that because men and women grow up in segregated or same-sex and segregated and same-sex play groups, they develop different conversational styles. Tannen suggests that if adults learn their way of speaking as children growing up in a separate social world of peers, then conversation between men and women is cross-cultural communication. In order to bridge the gap between these two cultures, Tannen suggests that men and women become bi-dialectical, or capable of adopting, or at very least capable of understanding, the other gender's conversational rules. Early in her book, Deborah Tannen provides an anecdote from her marriage an illustration of the types of misunderstanding men and women experience based on their different conversational styles. Following the anecdote, she then presents these conclusions, which also serve as a summary of her primary findings presented in the book. This quote appears on your handout as quote number 2. Tannen says, "Having done the research that led to this book, I now see that my husband was simply engaging the world in a way that many men do, as an individual in a hierarchical social order in which he was either one up or one down. In this world, conversations are negotiations in which people try to achieve and maintain the upper hand if they can, and protect themselves from others' attempts to put them down and push them around. Life, then, is a contest to preserve independence and to avoid failure." She continues, "I, on the other hand, was approaching the world as many women do, as an individual in a network of connections. In this world, conversations are negotiations for closeness in which people try to seek and give confirmation and support, and to reach consensus. They try to protect themselves from others' attempt to push them away. Life, then, is a community, a struggle to preserve intimacy and avoid isolation. Though there are hierarchies in this world, too, there are hierarchies more of friendship than of power and accomplishment." Tannen's observations on the different roles conversation plays for men and women may explain why some women talk more in Relief Society than they do in Sunday school. These women may feel as though the class discussion in Relief Society focuses more on building connections and sharing personal experiences than displaying expertise over scripture and doctrine. In early June, I watched women stay out of a conversation in my own gospel doctrine class when a participant made a doctrinally incorrect statement about the Melchizedek priesthood and the temple during Solomon's times. In response, two of the male members of the class quickly thumbed through their Bible dictionaries in order to correct the false statement. During the conversation that marked the rise and resolution of this conflict, the women were quiet, including the teacher. Tannen's theories of conversation would predict that female class members may feel personally attacked when they are challenged on points of doctrine, which may lead women to choose being quiet rather than to risk the possibility of a challenge. The discussion I led on the Book of Ruth illustrated Tannen's findings in another way. Women did comment during that lesson, but one shared an experience about her mother-in-law, and another woman talked about using a verse from this book of the Bible in her wedding announcement. The men's comments focused on establishing who knew the most about Levirate laws that determine who was Ruth's nearest kinsman and determine how she was finally married to Boaz. In addition to the summary that Tannen herself provides in the opening chapter of her book, I have reproduced a table that I penned in the front cover of my copy of her book, compiled during my reading. If you'll look at Table 1 on your handout, you will find a list of traits Tannen attributes to the conversation styles of men, which contrast with the traits she attributes to the conversational styles of women. One of Tannen's points is that these styles do indeed contrast, so she usually presents these in pairs throughout her book. Okay, so according to Deborah Tannen's research, men's conversational style reflects the values of independence, knowledge, hierarchy, problem-solving, reporting, public talk, status via expertise, authority, challenging others, listening is one downmanship, and self. And then the women's conversational style reflects the values of connection, empathy, equality, rapport, private talk, status via shared secrets, support, agreeing with others, listening is connection, and community. For example, she argues that men's conversation work to display knowledge they possess, even if this means shifting the conversation to an area of their expertise. She adds that women's conversation works to display empathy, even if they have to exaggerate their personal experience in order to establish common ground. If you look at these two columns, you can get a quick overview of her findings about gender and conversational style. Teachers may find this list valuable when planning the content of their lessons and the types of questions they will ask and types of discussion they will foster. For example, I try to structure my lessons so that I have a balance between conveying knowledge on points of doctrine and asking questions about how we can apply this knowledge to our contemporary lives. I have noticed that men tend to dominate the discussion about ancient Israel's politics, history, and religion, while the women tend to dominate the discussions on how they see parallels to the principles of these stories in their everyday lives. While we're looking at this list of contrasting styles, I want to stand back for a minute to add a few qualifications. Even though I am making comments about the way men and women speak, I must concede that these categories are based on generalizations, which may or may not hold true for every specific man and every specific woman. I have seen many examples of men who speak with empathy, who seek community, and who show support. Likewise, I've also seen many women who speak to establish expertise, who challenge others' authority, and who approach problems with a solution rather than a heavy dose of empathy. Nevertheless, I think tannins cast male and female and the traits she attributes to these two groups are useful for evaluating the meta-messages, evaluating the goals and assumptions of conversation. Even though the act of dividing people into two polarized categories is flawed, I think tannins and other researchers' observations on gender can contribute positively to discussions about who talks when, about what, for how long. In other words, I also hope that applying these observations to a mixed-gender class, some quieter men may feel more comfortable making contributions during gospel doctrine class as well. Okay, that hedge aside, let me continue. The second work I would like to apply to a Sunday school setting is Carol Gilligan's book, In a Different Voice, Psychological Theory and Women's Development. Gilligan's book starts with an explanation that many giants in the field of psychology evaluated women as inferior in their moral development when placed in models constructed with men as the norm. And I understand, as an aside, this happens in the field of medicine as well. You get the male anatomy as norm and female as abnormal. I have a sister who's diabetic who has real-life problems because a lot of the research done on diabetics is done on male subjects and not female, because that whole menstrual cycle messes everything up. Many of the models that Gilligan investigated value independence and abstract thinking, which leaves women measuring up short. Gilligan points out how Freud, Erikson, Piaget, and others all conclude that women are flawed morally when compared to men. She then focuses much of her research on challenging the conclusions made by psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg, who, not so coincidentally, was her mentor during her graduate studies. Kohlberg's model of moral development was grounded in the rationale that his subjects made in response to a hypothetical situation designed to place the rights of life in conflict with the rights of property. Again, the aim of Kohlberg's research was to evaluate the rationale for the moral decision, not the moral decision itself. So he didn't care if they chose property or life. It was just how they justified it. Kohlberg's theories, like Freud's, Erikson's, and Piaget's, value independence as a primary task of adulthood and abstract principle-based thinking as the most advanced means for making moral decisions. Gilligan suggests that women possess an alternate, not an inferior, system of morals, one that values connectedness and relationships. However, Kohlberg places many women in his research in an inferior position on his scale. What Gilligan suggests initially is an adoption of two separate but equal models for moral development. In the conclusion of her book, she edits this and says that we should blend the two models, male and female, to create an adult model of moral development. Not only does Gilligan conduct her own research by interviewing several women faced with a different moral dilemma, she also reviews some of the transcripts from Kohlberg's research in order to illustrate the different ways these subjects rationalize their decisions. In one section of her book, Gilligan reviews the different approaches a male and female child, both 11 years old, have made. These two are asked to respond to Kohlberg's dilemma involving impoverished Heinz, his dying wife, and the refusing druggist. Gilligan then draws these conclusions about the children's methods for moral reasoning in response to this hypothetical situation. And if you look at quote 3 on your handout, I have this section from Gilligan's book. And this is her analysis of these two subjects. Just as Jake is confident the judge would agree that stealing is the right thing for Heinz to do, so Amy is confident that if Heinz and the druggist had talked it out long enough, they could have reached something besides stealing. As he considers the laws to have mistakes, so she sees this drama as a mistake, believing that the world should just share things more and then people wouldn't have to steal. Both children thus recognize the need for agreement, but see it as mediated in different ways. He impersonally through a system of logic and law, she personally, he impersonally through systems of logic and law, she personally through communication and relationships. Just as he relies on the convictions of logic to deduce the solution, so she relies on a process of communication, assuming connection and believing that her voice will be heard. Yet while his assumptions about agreement are confirmed by the convergent logic between his answers and the questions posed, her assumptions are belied by the failure of communication, the interviewer's inability to understand her response. In other words, Kohlberg's model disallowed the the researcher from even seeing the framework that Amy was using to respond. And they often, with the female subjects in Kohlberg's study, kept trying to ask them questions to get them to pit the rights of property and the rights of life against each other on this scale. And a lot of times the female subjects were simply using a completely different scale. So Kohlberg and his researchers complained that these girls weren't even answering the questions logically. Okay. Gilligan's research implies that women's comments might focus more on exploring the nature of relationships when determining what action to take. This might explain why many women, when discussing gospel principles, whether in Relief Society or gospel doctrine classes, respond by explaining specific family problems and their rationale for how to address these specific family problems. On the contrary, the members of the gospel classes I've attended tend to focus more on the specifics of the standard works or the fine points of doctrine, more than offering personal struggles as an illustration of the lesson's themes. Okay, so that's, again, another binary that I want to hedge on. I do concede that both Relief Society and gospel doctrine participants talk about doctrine and apply these principles to their lives, but the ratio tends to tip one way or the other, depending on the gender of the class members. I've never attended priesthood meetings, but so I would have to rely on what others have reported on the ratio of doctrine to personal application to see if Gilligan's theories hold true in that all-male setting. And she would hypothesize they would mainly talk about gospel principles and doctrine. Okay, interestingly enough, Gilligan herself provides an example from the Old Testament that illustrates the difference between man's willingness to sacrifice people to truth, which links to the biblical Abraham. According to Gilligan, Abraham prepared to sacrifice the life of his son in order to demonstrate the integrity and supremacy of his faith. Abraham stands in implicit contrast to the woman who comes before Solomon and verifies her motherhood by relinquishing truth in order to save the life of her child. I don't quite agree with the way Gilligan sets up these two examples, because I believe the differences lies not in the details of the story itself, but the interpretation. I have been involved in discussions of Abraham's sacrifice that frame his decision as placing the relationship to God as his greatest priority. And I have discussed the other woman before Solomon as submitting to the authority of the king over common sense conclusions that a half-child will not live. Nevertheless, I accept her interpretations of the two biblical accounts as coming from one of many possible gender perspectives. I just don't agree with the way she presents it, because she says there's like only one way to do a gendered perspective on these. To illustrate how the same subject matter can evoke different responses depending on the participant's gender, let me compare two occasions when one lesson from the new Relief Society and Priesthood Manual evoked two different responses. At the beginning of the year, we started the manual with an overview of Brigham Young's life. The Relief Society teacher made no mention of the absence of Brigham Young's polygamous marriages. In that chapter, you only hear about Brigham Young's one wife, no polygamy mentioned. When one Relief Society class member asked about this, the rest of the sisters expressed anxiety about even bringing this up, which I interpreted as wanting to stay with the authority of the manual and wanting to avoid conflict, and the discussion was quickly closed down. In contrast, the Elders' Quorum teacher interjected this fact about Brigham Young from the beginning of his lesson, and the men talked at some length about the way members and non-members see polygamy in the history of the early LDS Church, so they embraced that problem and controversy. More recently, I've observed that the same lesson, Eternal Progression, in Relief Society and Priesthood Manuals being taught in two different ways. The discussion in our ward's Relief Society focused on developing relationships as the primary dimension of eternal progression, especially family relationships. The Elders' Quorum teacher shared his notes and participants' comments, which he explained reflected this discussion that included taking personal responsibility for individual choices as the key element of eternal progression. So again, you see connectedness in relationships in the women's discussion and a sense of individuality and rights and responsibilities in the men's class. Eternal progression then was maximizing one's individuality in priesthood. These examples from my wards, all women and all men classes, seem to follow Tannen's and Gilligan's theory about gender, about speaking styles, and about moral development. Okay, and the third work I would like to apply to a Sunday school setting is the multiple-authored book, Women's Ways of Knowing, The Development of Self, Voice, and Mind. Authors Belenke, Clinchy, Goldberger, and Terul adopt a similar goal as Carol Gilligan. Instead of seeking to expand on Kohlberg's model, Belenke and her co-authors find that William Perry's model of intellectual development excludes women, primarily because female subjects were screened out of his subjects group. When they did not advance on his model in the same way as his male subjects did, he just threw them out. Nevertheless, Perry's model has served as a foundation for developing curricula and writing textbooks in the late 20th century. In order to create a place for women in higher education, Belinky and her co-authors interviewed a number of women in traditional and non-traditional classrooms. They discover that most of these women explain their intellectual development through a metaphor of voice. The women explain how they moved from silence in the presence of authority to mimicking that authority, then using a newly discovered voice to challenge that authority, and then finally establishing their own voice as on par with existing authorities. The women Belinky and her co-authors interview describe how they establish their sense of self-mind and voice to a large degree from their family roles, or their roles in family systems, and from their belief that anyone in a position of authority, including school teachers, textbook authors, and curriculum planners, cannot be questioned because these authorities possess the truth. Women in the early stages of development do not recognize that a lot of knowledge springs forth from the speaker's values, self-interest, background, and experience, rather than being universal truth, capital T. Many of these women choose silence because they doubt their own experience, or they do not believe they can convince others to accept their silent and only thought point of view. In worst-case scenarios, many of these women who were interviewed by Belinky and her co-authors could not even recognize an inner voice, an individual point of view, or a self that differed from what the most outspoken member of their household believed or what their teachers taught them to believe about themselves and their ideas. Once women experienced a conflict between their lived experience and knowledge that others tried to pass off to them, then the women reached a state of crisis that caused for a change in the way they saw the origins of knowledge. Then they weren't just passive receptors. For example, I attended a relief study lesson a few years ago in Santa Barbara where the teacher, a lifelong member of the LDS Church, spoke harshly about Catholics, describing them as living spiritually incomplete lives. Many members of the class were converts from Catholicism who valued what they learned about Christian behavior and who still maintained close ties with their extended family who were still Catholic. Because the women in the class experienced a truth that contradicted the teacher's statement about Catholics having incomplete lives, many of them chose to challenge the teacher's authority in order to integrate their lives as LDS members in their public selves and their pasts as Catholics with their present relationships with their Catholic family members. That was a wild day in Relief Society. According to Belinky, Clenchy, Goldberger, and Terrell's research, women who chose to be quiet in gospel doctrine may not have the self-confidence to challenge the teacher's interpretation of the standard works, even if that individual woman has a different point of view to offer. I've observed women de-emphasize their own opinion when they do offer an alternate interpretation. They often hedge by prefacing it with comments such as, I may not be correct, or, oh, this is only my opinion. These hedges invite the teacher and other class members to just dismiss their comments too readily. Belinky and her co-authors describe the final stage of self-voice in mind by drawing on comments made by three of the subjects they interviewed, Kay, Erica, and Adele. Please refer to your handout for quote number 4. Belinky and her co-authors conclude that to learn to speak in a unique and authentic voice, women must jump outside the frames and systems authorities provide and create their own frame. Kay, Erica, and Adele told us that their current way of knowing and viewing the world, a way of knowing we call constructed knowledge, began as an effort to reclaim the self by attempting to integrate knowledge that they felt intuitively was personally important with knowledge they had learned from others. They told of weaving together the strands of rational and emotive thought and of integrating objective and subjective knowing. Rather than extricating the self in the acquisition of knowledge, these women use themselves in rising to a new way of thinking. As Adele described it, you let the inside out and the outside in. In applying these ideas to a Sunday school setting, Belinky and her co-authors invite members of a gospel doctrine class, indirectly, of course, to find ways to integrate their inner lives with the participation in a community such as the LDS Church. This is an activity I can identify with on many levels. Like the women in their study, I find that I must jump outside the frames and systems of authority provided and create my own frame. As a graduate student in rhetoric and composition, I had a number of fellow students ask me, how could I become a member of an academic community while still participating in a religious community? One student even suggested denouncing God was a prereq for graduation for the PhD program. I thought, what, you take the language acquirement, do your comps, denounce God, then defend your dissertation? I didn't see that on the form. I find that I must find a way to weave together the strands of both these communities by talking about my academic work in church settings and talking about my religious experiences in academic settings. I appreciate the occasion of this conference for allowing me to work towards an integration of my inner voice and my public voice. I wonder how many women sit in Sunday school thinking interesting thoughts, but wondering how to bring these ideas into a public forum that has already so many strong voices of authority, written or spoken. That might make them feel like they can't do it without being challenged much. A final work I would like to briefly apply and concluding to a Sunday school setting is Nell Nodding's Caring, A Feminine Approach to Ethics and Moral Education. Okay, Gilligan contrasts a male ethic of responsibility with a female ethic of caring. However, Gilligan doesn't provide an elaborate theoretical model. She mainly shares with you transcripts of interviews and some theorizing. Instead, she illustrates it by sharing segments from an extensive interview she and her co-researchers conducted. For a more thorough description of an ethic of care that's philosophically based, look at Nell Nodding's book. As a philosopher, Nodding seeks to describe the ethic of care by drawing connections and making distinctions between this ethic and the long-standing philosophical traditions that assumed ethical systems based on men's lived experiences. The most powerful lived experience that Nodding sees as shaping women's ethical systems is the experience of motherhood. That's her primary metaphor. This relationship serves as a primary model for her moral development. Nodding also makes suggestions on how to transform the classroom in order to promote an ethic of care. Basically, she calls for teachers and students to de-emphasize the task of transmitting information or even cultivating an aesthetic in favor of emphasizing a relationship of care between the teacher and the student. Okay, so that relationship is now foregrounded, when that usually in a traditional classroom is backgrounded, and the banking of information is what gets foregrounded. And this is her quote, which is short enough that I didn't put it on the handout. Okay, from Nodding's. In pointing to the maintenance and enhancement of caring as a primary aim of education, I'm drawing attention to priorities. I certainly do not intend to abandon intellectual and aesthetic aims. However, we cannot separate means and ends in education because the desired result is part of the process. The process carries with it a notion of a person's undergoing it becoming somehow better. Okay, so it's the process of teaching, not just being taught. In other words, Nodding insists that the classroom be a place where we enact, and not just define and rehearse, but we enact our ethical ideals. Instead of seeing the classroom as an artificial environment for receiving knowledge about ethics and morality. With this in mind, I hope that we can examine the ways that we talk to each other in this gospel doctrine, the ways we foster participation, and the ways we invite people to contribute, so that in gospel doctrine we can enact our visions of the Christian community at the same time as we discuss the gospel and the doctrines of this community. Thank you.
The implications of Karen's paper are so far-reaching. It was very hard for me to focus in on just one thing to respond to. As a matter of fact, if you intended to come here and hear a heated debate on the validity of her research or whether or not it's applicable to the church, then you're in the wrong place. They should have had a man here responding. Everything I read in her paper, I was just writing in the margin, yes, oh, this is great. I have not had a formal academic setting since I left the university. Having received my degree, I was just grateful that I'd read Deborah Tannen's book so I could understand a little bit of what she was saying about the interaction between men and women and the difference in the way we speak to each other. It just seemed to me that if we could understand this, think what it would do for our relationships in the church. Think if the bishop could understand what the Relief Society president meant when he was having a PPI with her, how much less misunderstanding there would be. Or if the young men's president or the young women's president could have that kind of understanding. Any of you have ever been in that position? It's much worse than a marriage. Very difficult. So what I did, because I felt I wish all of you could have a copy of her paper so you could just go through the thought processes and use this to understand all the different areas in which it reaches. But what I did was just to go into one area, and that is a teacher of one sex has students of another sex in her classroom, and how does this idea of communication play out in that kind of a situation, because all throughout the church we have those kinds of situations, not just in gospel doctrine. And I have my experience of 3 years of teaching release time seminary to high school students that I will focus on. I was interested that Karen made these observations about women and their response in the gospel doctrine class when she was a student, before she became the teacher of the gospel doctrine class. And I wondered how would she have thought of that, although she might have probably with her background, had she already been the gospel doctrine teacher. So my feeling is that it's time to work on the teachers of our classrooms. She talks about having gone to a teacher development course and tried to raise these questions. If we're training teachers, shouldn't we train them to respond to different genders? And getting that negative response, oh no, this doesn't play out in our classrooms. Are our teachers ready to know and understand that there is a difference in how the two genders respond in a classroom? I had an experience myself of being a Stake Relief Society education counselor and running a seminar for Relief Society teachers in which I said to them, what do you teach? I asked them to raise their hands. What do you teach? I teach spiritual living. I teach cultural refinement. I teach whatever. And I was reminded of, I overheard a conversation at a regional teaching conference for middle school teachers in which the same question was asked, what do you teach? One teacher responded, I teach English. What do you teach? And the other one said, I teach 7th and 8th grade students. So different focus, are we teaching subjects or are we teaching students? We are called as gospel doctrine teachers. We're not called as teachers of adult Sunday school class. So our focus already is on the subject that we teach, not on the students that are in our classrooms. I also agreed with the research, and she pointed out that children at a very early age learn this different way of communicating. Little girls learn to play dolls and play with each other and emphasize those relationships, and that's how they talk to each other. Little boys do trucks, and I had an example about a girl coming in with a truck and how it changes the entire dynamic of the situation if she can bring her own truck to the conversation. I would like to tell you, however, that there is hope. Never mind the fact that the children already get to us in high school with these stereotypes, there is hope. We can influence them when they're in high school. And I'll use my experience in seminary to back this up. Mine, of course, all my research is anecdotal. I haven't read as much as Karen, and I hope that that will help some of you who also are not in that position to be able to come to realize that there is hope for our influence. 3 years ago, when I first volunteered to teach seminary and release time, the subject was Old Testament, and I was given the juniors and seniors in high school for my class. I thought that we would have great discussions. These kids were 16, 17 years old, and this would be wonderful. I had a rudimentary understanding of the Old Testament. I thought I'd been through gospel doctrine classes. I taught a lot. I was completely unprepared for what met me on a daily seminary basis at the high school release time. I was a little bit intimidated because some of the first questions that the kids asked about the creation right in the very beginning of the Old Testament were things that I didn't exactly know how to answer. And I was uncomfortable, again, looking at it from the paper's point of view, saying, I don't know that. I'll go look that up. I was bound and determined that I was not going to say, go ask your dad. So I didn't resort to that. I learned, however, through the semester that knowledge was only about this much of what those kids came to seminary to learn. And so when it came time for the second semester and I had a new class, I took a new tack. I was then teaching the second half of the Old Testament. I'll use an example. I had two boys, two brothers in that class. One brother was an AP student, had many high-powered academic classes, and his older brother was a learning disabled student. And they had kind of gone together. They were just 1 year apart in school, and they had kind of gone together throughout the seminary system. Academic brother to get him through the seminary class. I was fortunate that I knew their mother from the neighborhood. So I had these two, I did not know the boys, I had the two boys. The mother shared with me about 4 weeks into the semester that the AP student, her AP son, had come to her the first 2 days and said, "I have a woman teacher for seminary. I know I'm not going to learn very much this semester." He didn't know me at all. He just knew that I was a woman, and he'd always had seminary teachers who were men. She said, "I tell you this to tell you that now 4 weeks into this semester, he has learned a tremendous amount, and he comes home every night and tells us what he had learned." And I said, "Wow, what has he learned?" I was just so incredulous that he had learned that much. And it was a total mixture of knowledge and relationship. It was a total mixture. And I was really pleased that that happened. The learning disabled brother, on the other hand, who was used to relying on his academic brother, cut me total slack. He had no expectations. I was the teacher. He was there to learn, and he just grew by leaps and bounds. And you know, he treated me at the same way he treated the other teachers. At the end of the class period, he would say, "Good job, Fowles," and he would give me a high five. And that was the way he let me know that he was liking my classroom. Last winter, I had another classroom. I was called and asked to take a class that had 40 students. They were dividing, and would I please take the overflow so that we wouldn't have such a large classroom. And the principal gave the students their choice. "There will be another classroom. How many of you would like to move out of brother so-and-so's class into this other classroom?" They were not told who the teacher would be. They had to take a chance. 18 kids took a chance. Only 5 of them were boys. So for an entire semester, I had a class with 18 students, and it 5 boys, 13 girls. One boy in particular, the very second day when I said, "All of you, do you have your scriptures?" said, "I do not have mine." Raised his hand, said, "I did not bring my scriptures." And he continued to not bring his scriptures. But he could quote the scriptures verbatim. It was a Book of Mormon, and when I would throw out a scripture, he would quote it. So then I began to tease him, "Well, I guess Dan doesn't need to bring his scriptures because he has the scriptures memorized." But secretly, I was intimidated because I knew that this boy knew a lot about the scriptures. Was I going to be able to do anything for him this semester of seminary? I continued to think in terms of focusing on that. The last week of the term, I gave the students what I have done in the past, asked them to respond. How was your testimony affected by your study of the Book of Mormon? Dan wrote me a note on the back of his paper. It said, "Sister Fowles, when I came into this classroom, I didn't think you could teach me anything. And now I have appreciated a semester of seeing the scriptures from a different point of view." That says to me, in those experiences and in all the classes that I've had in seminary, that teenagers are still, we can still affect them and we can still appeal to them, that everybody needs to be comfortable. And so that brings me to what I call maybe the solutions to our gospel doctrine dilemma. The first is that we need to have more mixture in our teaching. There needs to be more women. There needs to be an idea, not that men have knowledge and therefore a woman cannot be a teacher. We certainly need this in our seminary classes, and we need this in our gospel doctrine. Fortunately, I think a lot of wards are seeing that need, and many, many gospel doctrine teachers are women. Secondly, I would give as an example the team teach approach. Again, we see this in many wards. Gospel doctrine is too heavy and too big a job for one person, so we will team teach, and we will take turns every other week doing this team teaching. This, however, is not the team approach that I'm talking about. I'm talking about what I see as an example in my own ward, which is a male and female teacher who began this process in January by meeting together, finding common goals for what they wanted for the classroom, and can talk to each other every week about what happened, especially if one or the other cannot be there. This is not just a "I come, I teach, I go home, and I never know what happens in the rest of the classroom." And this is a male and a female. This is regular touch base and common goals. The next item is that I think we need to assume that women want knowledge and they want to be advanced in their understanding of the gospel, and men want to have an idea about how to relate and how to relate the characters of the scriptures to each other and to their own lives. Women are not looking for a debate or one-upmanship, and men are not looking to have their feelings touched, but they are looking to integrate. And if we can understand that and assume that, then we can support that in our gospel doctrine classes. And the last thing I would say as a teacher, if we're going to change the teachers, if they would just ask themselves, other than what Karen has done, obviously, in thinking about her classroom, take it one step further in focusing on the students for each lesson rather than on the subject for each lesson. And the first question would be, have I set an atmosphere in my classroom in which everyone feels comfortable telling either their doctrinal points or their feelings without fear of being called on the doctrinal point or being considered not intelligent because they're giving their feelings? Have I created that atmosphere? Secondly, do I know my students well enough that I can gear my lesson to what those students might need? Now, in our ward, my husband is the gospel doctrine teacher, and for 6 years he was the bishop. So he knows the students in the gospel doctrine class, and he does take the lessons and gear those lessons towards what he knows the students in his class need. And the last thing is, can I let go of the tenets of my lesson in order to create edification for all the students in my classroom? Sometimes we hold so tenaciously to what we're trying to teach that we forget, and from my point of view, that the students are there to be edified. So I would just submit to you that, albeit it is a formidable task, that we would try to be a blending of these styles in our gospel doctrine classes, but nevertheless, if that will be our focus, it will be a very rewarding one, and our gospel doctrine classrooms will be very exciting. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Karen and Catherine for their presentations. Do we have any questions today? We do need them on the mic, so do you want to come up and repeat them, or should we?
Yeah, you can just say them, and we'll repeat them in the mic, so you don't have to come up here. Nadine, did you have a question?
I'm having an argument with Janet about who's going to go first. I don't want to.
While you were talking, I recognized something about my own communication that I hadn't thought of before. And it's when you're talking about the idea of authority and when we make comments and things. We had in our gospel doctrine class over the last year a man and a woman who taught, and they alternated weeks. It wasn't before we had a team teacher, it was a husband and wife. But last year we had a man and a woman. And what I realized was that I made comments more when the man taught than when the woman taught. Now, I should preface this by saying that about 5 years ago, I made a conscious decision to say more in Sunday school. And it wasn't the male-female thing, but just the feeling that I had that the people who dominate the conversation in church are the people who have the most conservative, traditional ideas. And I wanted to have people think about more some other ideas. I just wanted to bring something up and get people used to the ideas of seeing gospel principles in maybe a little bit different light. And so in order to do that, I started making a conscious effort before I went to class to study the lesson and to formulate some thoughts so that I would have something to say. What happened in the last year, or actually last couple of years, is that the man really enjoyed my comments a lot because he was kind of open. He liked class discussion, and he didn't feel threatened by what I said. The woman had very strict ideas about what kinds of things should be taught and what kinds of things should be said in class, and I never felt welcome saying anything in her class because for one thing, it wasn't really welcome to add another viewpoint. And for another thing, I felt like she felt very intimidated by me. And I didn't want to further intimidate her. And so I essentially silenced myself. And I guess I didn't want to one-up her.
And hurt her feelings.
And I'm just wondering if you have any comments about how to state a dissenting, or not even dissenting, but just an alternative view of things without sounding like I'm trying to one-up somebody.
Yeah,
I do have a strategy on that, but I actually got it from my husband. he likes to make comments in Sunday school class, and so do I. In fact, when I moved to Santa Barbara to marry him, and he'd been in a bishopric there, I felt like the more he talked, the smaller I got, so I was making all these noises in class. But what he does when he wants to make a comment to the teacher, especially if it's contradicting, and especially if it's a woman teacher who feels already as though her authority is challenged, he'll spend a lot of time saying, you know, I agree with you, blah, 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 3 minutes of, I agree with you, and this is great, this is great, this is great, and then 30 seconds of, well, but, you know, I do have this one question here, and it's kind of stated, like, through the back door, and you have to read between the lines to see his objection or his alternate point of view, and then another minute of, but I really like what you're saying, at da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So he kind of does the sandwich job, I guess, so. But, yeah, it does get complex when you start thinking of, you know, female teacher, female students, and back and forth, where I focus mainly on just the female-male students in the class discussing to this, like, non-gendered teacher. So that's an interesting question.
Along with the idea of the differences is how we present our differing opinions. We have a lady in our gospel doctrine class who always likes to do the opposing opinion. No matter what the subject, she always does the opposing opinion. And that we were talking about golden cows, the worship of golden cows, and she brought up the fact that we were talking about the female and necessarily these worship, that we were not necessarily worshiping golden cows, the female. And so could we please stop referring to them as cows? And so my husband said, okay, golden bovine, so that we can just be very neutral here. But I think the point was just, again, it's how it gets presented, whether it's to the man. Men are very used to that, combative, and don't take it personally, and women do. That's been my experience.
Yeah, and I mean, in talking, Blinking and her co-authors talk a lot about how your family roles determine how you participate in public forum. And, you know, being a kind of a loud, outspoken woman myself, I can see that as being true, that that not all women are going to be this cowering, whatever you say. And it's interesting to kind of see how they grew up and what kind of household, if, like, everybody around the dinner table is going to talk and really jump in there, or if it's, like, this low-conflict family where male and female, everybody's really indirect and kind of passive-aggressive about conflict. So it all gets complicated when you think of all these different variables. So I kind of suggested in my head, I was kind of simplifying things in order to state some of these ideas, but once you start dealing with real-life human beings, you get so many variables that kind of spins out of control if you analyze it a lot. Any other questions? Janet?
This is a microphone for short people. Okay. My question is, a lot of this discussion is focused on what the students in the class, such as, you know, Nadine was saying, can do differently. What can be done to change the teachers? I mean, what do you do when you have a teacher who puts down every comment that's made by a woman? I mean, puts it down very directly and very rudely, something like that.
Yeah, the research that is focused on academic settings, even by teachers who are self-proclaimed feminists, who say that they're trying to incorporate women more, the taped classroom discussions show that women's comments tend to be, oh yeah, thanks, and go on, where the men's comments tend to be woven into the discussion, and the teachers say, you know, as Jim says, da-da-da-da-da, or Jim has an interesting point, and they continue to weave it into the course. Yeah, I mean, now that I'm teaching gospel doctrine, it's often after the fact that I analyze what happened in the classroom and go, oh, oh, oh. But I try to just keep a balance between, okay, let's, like, look at how many cubits the temple was in Solomon's day and how many wives he had and what he was doing with blending idolatry with the gospel, and then do how can we liken this unto ourselves? And I really see this split. I can do at the beginning of the class all this banking, as Paulo Freire would say, just like giving information. Here, I'm smart. I'm the teacher. I know stuff. I can fill you up with knowledge. Pass knowledge. And then about 20 minutes after doing that, and I feel confident, okay, they respect me now because I just did all this banking. Now I can relax and say, what does this mean? How can we apply this? And I usually end up telling little self-deprecating stories, kind of the way John Donne did in his sermons, like, oh, sinner I am, you know, or try to do wacky applications like looking at workout videos as a form of idolatry that we, like, you know, worship and bend in front of these like, unrealistic images of bodies, you know, as pagan in some sort of way. And that tends to loosen people up, and I get a lot more, I was thinking about this the other day, and in my family, and trying to do family prayer, and I was arguing with my husband. So that's, as a teacher, how I try to do it, is do banking and then applying. And I tend to get the mixed gender that way.
In a perfect world, and I'd like to see teacher training in which we incorporate this kind of thing in our teacher training. But unfortunately, as I tried to say, I don't know if teachers are ready for that. I tried in that seminar that I did for my Relief Society teachers in my stake to say, let's focus on the students now. Let's think about who's in your Relief Society classes. Just on, and we're just doing same gender, so we're not even talking about how to incorporate men. And how can you do this? How can you get to know your students? And I had a whole packet full of things that they could do in taking learning styles and all those kinds of things into consideration. And, you know, they just weren't ready to do that. They just, you know, that went okay, and then they just went home and nothing changed. So in a perfect world, if we just continue to have a few of us who know how to do this and think about this, you know, maybe we can make some inroads into teacher training. And that's, to me, that's where it needs to begin. Not everybody can have Karen as their gospel doctrine teacher.
Yes, Keith?
I was a little frustrated and concerned. I've never looked at a Sunday school classroom as a battlefield. I see it more as an experience of sharing gospels, teachings, and traditions in that section.
Yeah.
I understand some of the things that can be there, but
Keith's comment is that the presentation tends to describe the gospel doctrine class as a battlefield, and his perception has been that there hasn't been this type of contention in the classroom. That's a common comment made by those who feel they already have a voice. Like if you look at studies about like race and gender, that the people who already enjoy the privilege don't see the problem. Or maybe you have the class you've been in has a good balance. But I'm a really outspoken person. It really wasn't until I moved to Santa Barbara and my husband had been the bishopric, and there was a lot of graduate students who were really, really outspoken, that for the first time in my life I felt really shut down in there. And there were only two other women who even talked in that class, and they both were getting graduate degrees, and all the other women were wives of graduate students and did not talk in gospel doctrine. Yeah, no, it was, this is Santa Barbara, Central California. But yeah, women have the stereotype of talking nonstop, but that's in the private domain. In the public domain, they talk less and are prone to be interrupted more, and they talk more briefly. Question? Your name?
Christy.
Okay, Christy's making a comment about how in an academic setting of BYU, she's seen as the teacher that her male students often cut her off and question her authority. And you had a further comment?
Yeah, well, and just, I was also in...
So as a team teacher with a man, he took like 45 minutes and you had 10?
Yeah, he would go first. You know,
he'd go first and take the time.
How it was supposed to be. And then he would take up almost the entire time, and then I'd have 5 minutes to get whatever portion of the lesson was.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and a parallel, I think, is we need to wrap up here because we're getting people from the next session. I've noticed in wards that when couples speak, the woman goes first and says, "Hi, we're the Browns, and we're from Texas, and we have 5 kids. And they do the touchy-feely, this is who we are. And the man gets up there and says, "This is my doctrinal understanding of this principle, and it's very deep and profound." You know. And I've actually had friends where... my friend Scott gets up and says, "Hi, we're the Crofts, and we're friendly, happy people." And Lisa, who's an attorney, gets up there, "This is my really deep, profound doctrinal understanding." Okay, thank you very much for your comments. And if you want to see a copy of this paper, it's on our webpage, which is listed on your handout. And email me if you want to talk about this more. Email me.